It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Even though he died 400 years ago, William Shakespeare is a household name around the world. And today, we're going to go back in time to when he was an unknown poet, publishing his first work. Adam Hooks is an assistant professor in the Department of English and the Center for the Book at the University of Iowa. He's the author of Selling Shakespeare, Biography, Bibliography, and the Book Trade. He was also instrumental in bringing a copy of Shakespeare's first folio to Iowa City this summer. The folio has moved on, but the exhibit around it remains at the University of Iowa Library on campus. And Adam is with me now. Hello, Adam.
Hello, Charity. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for coming in. And I want to start with a big question. Okay, 400 years after the death of Shakespeare, many, many people have written about him. There are many biographies that have been published. Why try to add to that at this point in time?
There are several reasons for that, and one is that even though it has been 400 years, we still continue to make new discoveries, find new evidence, find new information about Shakespeare's life and his career. So it's still an exciting time to be a Shakespeare scholar and to be writing about Shakespeare. The second thing is that there are always new stories to tell with the things that we already know or the things that we think that we already know, the things that we take for granted. And so in part, my scholarship is aimed at telling different stories, using both new evidence that I've found myself and also just reconsidering both evidence and previous narratives that have been told about Shakespeare.
And, of course, with so many historical figures, I think of, you know, George Washington and the wooden teeth, there are these myths that grow up around the figures in our history. And Shakespeare himself has been mythologized in many ways. So as a Shakespeare scholar, is that part of the work to figure out what is true and what is not, even if it's been repeated so many times?
I would say that my job is to find out what constitutes the truth at different moments in time. Because as you say, there are lots of myths and stories that have been told about Shakespeare, and they started being told during his lifetime. And through the rest of the 17th and into the 18th centuries, these anecdotes and stories were repeated and circulated countless times. And it wasn't until much later that those were discounted as merely apocryphal stories or unreliable stories. It took a long time for people to desire and to need a more authentic, archivally based account of Shakespeare's life, because Shakespeare was known for telling stories. And if you go back and recover those, you get a very different version of Shakespeare than the one that we often think about today.
You decided to approach Shakespeare's life through the book trade, through the publishing industry, which in the 16th and early 17th century was a very, very different kind of industry than it is today. What made you decide to take that avenue?
Part of it results from some of the training that I had in graduate school, kind of falling in love with material artifacts, with books that were produced by people and held in their hands 400 years ago. That's part of the attraction of doing this kind of scholarship. But my intention in this book was to find out why Shakespeare became the kind of author that we recognize him as, or rather to think about the different ways that he was defined as an author, rather than as an actor or a member of his theater company, because he remains so central to our literary canon, and as you said at the top, a kind of globally recognized figure for literature. I wanted to find out how that version of Shakespeare became the version of Shakespeare, and how it overshadowed some of the other competing versions of Shakespeare that existed at the time.
Shakespeare scholars have always really wrestled with kind of a big gap in Shakespeare's life. There's this period of time where nobody really seems to know what happened. Give us an idea of what's missing there. What is this sort of big mystery period?
So Shakespeare drops out of the documentary record from about the middle of the 1580s when his children are born until the early 1590s when he's first recognized as a member of the London theater world. That first notice was an insult, by the way. It's fun to point out. So those years have become known as the lost years because we don't know exactly what he was doing. And there are, of course, a number of different options.
He probably was not a stay-at-home dad.
Probably not a stay-at-home dad for most of his life, it seems. It took a while for people to try to figure out exactly to even care about this gap. I mean, to have a gap in the documentary record, you first have to have an archivally based documentary record. And so starting in the early 18th century, there were various stories about how Shakespeare must have left Stratford. There's a famous story, the very first story that was brought forward to explain this, that Shakespeare fell in with the wrong crowd around Stratford and got caught poaching a deer from a local estate and was punished for it and then wrote a ballad that was so mean and vicious that he was forced to flee Stratford to London, where he took up work as this or that. So that it's literally professions from A to Z have been proposed for explaining what Shakespeare did in the early stages of his career.
So a lot of theories have been put out there. And as we talked about when we were talking about Shakespeare's first folio, the thing that brought him fame initially was his poetry. So what do we know now, looking at the books that he published and what we know about his life? What do we know about those early years as a poet?
Well, there's some really interesting stories surrounding that. The first work that Shakespeare wrote that was published was Venus and Adonis, this kind of erotic Ovidian narrative poem that became eventually the best-selling English poem in the entire Renaissance, and a lot of people have never heard of it. Its companion piece was called Lucrece, and it was published a year after, in 1594. This is early 1590s when this kind of poetry was really in vogue. They both became very successful in print and really made Shakespeare's reputation. So a play like Romeo and Juliet, its initial popularity, and in fact the initial interpretations of that play were very much influenced by his pre-existing reputation.
This is a love poet, so naturally he would write
exactly
this tragic romance.
Exactly. There are references to people speaking not but pure Juliet and Romeo as a way to attempt to woo their own beloved. The interesting thing for me, and this is really where my book project started years ago, is that the first editions of the two narrative poems happened to be printed by a man named Richard Field, who happened to come from Stratford-upon-Avon. And so that supposed connection between these two Stratford men has been interpreted for hundreds of years as Shakespeare kind of creating and authorizing his own status as an author in print. On the other hand, as I try to show, that's only one single moment. And Mr. Field, whatever his connection to Shakespeare may or may not have been, his investment in Shakespeare was very short-lived. And it really was the publisher and bookseller in one particular shop that for the next decade and a half, two decades, was responsible for selling and reprinting Shakespeare's poems. And so, you know, Shakespeare never needed to set foot in that bookshop, but he lived there in print for many, many years.
So getting published in 1594 as a poet, what would that have looked like? What would those books or chapbooks or pamphlets, I mean, what would have been the product?
The chapbook or pamphlet is an excellent model. They would have been slim little pamphlets, not even large enough to bind. They were simply stitched with thread, stab-stitched is what we call it, and circulated around London. We know that some early readers collected this kind of poetry, and when you collected enough pamphlets of poetry, you could have them bound together. So there are a couple of really interesting examples of Shakespeare's early narrative poems being bound together with other poems and plays on the same theme or in the same style. Because they were not sold bound, they're really ephemeral. There's only a single copy that exists now of the very first edition of Venus and Adonis, and it was owned by a woman, which I think is really fantastic, because people talked about the fact that women should not be allowed to read such kinds of poetry, because you never know what would happen if they read love poetry. Or in fact, you know exactly what will happen if they read love poetry.
So we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about Shakespeare's early life in publishing as a poet. We'll continue to talk about what we can learn about Shakespeare's life through looking at the publishing industry back in the 1590s and the early 1600s. With me today is Shakespearean scholar Adam Hooks. He's an assistant professor in the Department of English and the Center for the Book at the University of Iowa. He's also the author of the new book, Selling Shakespeare, Biography, Bibliography, and the Book Trade. We'll also get his thoughts in a few minutes on the news that Oxford University Press has decided to give credit to Christopher Marlowe as a co-author of three Henry VI plays. So we'll find out more about that in a few minutes as well. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the life of William Shakespeare. With me is Adam Hooks. He's an assistant professor in the Department of English and the Center for the Book at the University of Iowa and author of Selling Shakespeare, Biography, Bibliography, and the Book Trade. His book looks at Shakespeare's life through the lens of the publishing industry, a very new publishing industry back in the 16th and 17th century. And Adam, just before the break, we were talking about these little chapbooks or pamphlets of poetry that were published of Shakespeare's early poems. Try to put that in context for me in society. I mean, is there something that we have in publishing today that would be similar to I mean, those were poetry chapbooks are not that popular these days, but these were really popular, right?
Exactly. They were very popular. And if you're thinking about the material form, these really ephemeral, sometimes cheaply produced pamphlets, something like a comic book might come to mind. The analogy that I normally make is that in comparison to the first folio, this very large format book, much more expensive than an individual poem or play, if you go to your local bookstore and you go to the Shakespeare section, there will usually be a large, fancy, expensive, nice-looking edition of the complete works. And then there are a bunch of cheap paperbacks, normally only the plays that are the most popular, in fact, which were always the most popular, like Richard III and Hamlet and Romeo and Juliet. So if you use that as an analogy, you can kind of understand the differing price points for individual copies of Shakespeare's works.
All right, so these were cheap paperbacks and very popular.
Yes.
What would it have taken for Shakespeare to get published? I know that you've written about the fact that some people, I guess, don't like to look at Shakespeare as somebody who was seeking out publishing contracts. But from your perspective, from what you've learned, what would he have been doing to actively promote his work?
Actually, not very much. Unlike many of his contemporaries, including some of the working playwrights in the theater, he never really explicitly expressed an ambition to be an author in print. Many other writers did, but he did not. And it's not always clear how exactly those play scripts from the theater made their way into print. The theater company may have been involved in some way once he became a kind of established, successful playwright. Publishers may have sought out his works. There are a number of different possibilities that scholars have outlined over the years. But once that manuscript made its way to the printing house, it was owned by the publisher or the bookseller, and authors had no further rights. There was no system of copyright like we have today.
Or royalties?
Oh, no. Oh, no. Those belonged strictly to the publishers. The publisher is, we use these terms, that it means something slightly different in the Renaissance book trade, but the publisher is the person who put up the money. Like, they're the ones financially invested. They're the ones who are kind of possibly intellectually invested as well, in the sense that they want to make sure to get a return on their investment. So they're, in a sense, in choosing to publish a poem or a play, you're reading in a certain sense.
So you're looking at the life of Shakespeare, as many, many scholars do, through his work, but also through this timeline of publication. So what can you learn from about his life from, you know, looking at those poems that were published in 1594 and the subsequent years? What kind of insight does that give us into what Shakespeare was doing during that time?
I'm really glad that you asked that, because one of the reasons I'm so interested in the history of Shakespearean biography is that Shakespearean biographies have been popular for a very long time, and they continue to be produced at a kind of remarkable rate. And it's almost the kind of traditional cradle-to-grave biography is a pretty much exhausted form at this point. And so there have been scholars who have done more targeted microbiographies, like a single year in the life of Shakespeare. So I decided that rather than focusing on Shakespeare as the man or the writer, the historical person, I wanted to tell the story of Shakespeare as an author and the different ways that that changed over the course of the 17th century. And so what I've chosen to do is tell biographies of books and biographies of the people responsible for making the books, for selling them, for buying them, for collecting them, cataloging them, to see how Shakespeare's reputation shifted over the course of the 17th century until it became something like or available to become the Shakespeare that we recognize today.
The poetry was his early success in the publishing world. How were his plays first published? Was that something that he lived to witness quite a bit of?
Oh, yes, certainly. During his lifetime, he was a successful playwright in print. And by the late 1590s, his name starts appearing on title pages, rapidly proliferating. And he became identified with a handful of what we might think of as Renaissance blockbusters. Henry IV, Part One, which features Falstaff, which kind of had a life beyond the bounds of the play, or Richard III, the notorious, most notorious villain on the English stage. Hamlet and Romeo and Juliet were both also very popular from the moment that they were first published.
And again, let's put this in context. I mean, obviously there were novels being published during that time. How did the idea of plays as something that would be sold and read, were they considered to be similar to novels?
Oh, that's a tricky question to some degree. I'll answer that in a couple of different ways. And one is that printed plays were popular, and according to certain criteria, were a pretty decent investment for a publisher, and it doesn't, didn't take a lot of money. But they never reached the higher echelons of popularity. I mean, things like almanacs and Bibles and certain sermons, things that were printed and reprinted 20, 30, 40 times. It didn't quite reach that clearly. The second way to think about that is that there was a burgeoning English, what we would call maybe a literary culture in print. They didn't use that word literary like we use it today. But it certainly was taking part in this phenomenon of a generation or two of writers who had been well-educated, who had a lot to say, and who fashioned and refashioned the literary environment. And it's not so much that plays were necessarily more popular than any other genre. It's just that over time, plays became recognized as this distinct genre. Like, it's really easy to define. Like, a play is something that was performed at the professional theater, and then it gets printed, and they all look about the same, and they're the same size, and you can bind them together. Defining what a book of poetry is very difficult in relation to that. And so because plays became this distinct category, Shakespeare became more associated with plays as a playwright rather than as a poet.
I imagine the audience for plays, for the plays that Shakespeare wrote, now these days it's difficult to get to Broadway or London's West End to see performances of new plays. But of course, then they travel around the country. I mean, in Shakespeare's time, the audience, I can imagine, would be pretty small compared to the number of people who were hungry for these kinds of stories.
Yeah, if you're thinking about the purpose-built theaters in London, which were a relatively new phenomenon when Shakespeare arrived in London, they were large, but there's only so many people that you can fit into a theater at any given time, and plays didn't have the kinds of Broadway runs that we're familiar with today. There are occasions when they're repeated, but generally the theater companies wanted to rotate as many different plays as possible through the repertoire to keep people coming back. We know that theater companies also traveled around England to the provinces, but again, the potential to reach a wider audience over a number of years, because there was a used book trade, evidence of ownership over decades, even centuries. So of course, in print, the works are able to be preserved, and they're able to reach a much wider audience than any given single theatrical performance.
Your work kind of follows the pathway that William Shakespeare took, or that his work took, to becoming the best-selling work that we think of today. I was looking up what he is, the number one bestseller of all time, but pretty much tied with Agatha Christie, which I think is really an incredible achievement for Agatha Christie. So that pathway is so different from the modern pathway to becoming a best-selling author. I mean, do you have an idea for how Shakespeare would have thought of his work going into the world in that way? Clearly, he was working very hard and writing a lot.
Yes.
He was incredibly prolific. Was he also thinking about this work traveling?
That's really difficult to say. And again, it's one of the grand traditions of Shakespeare scholarship, and particularly Shakespeare biography, is to try to find Shakespeare's own thoughts and intentions within his works, because we don't have any external confirmation of what those intentions or desires
may have been. And in his work, there are these little nuggets of current events and pop culture at the time that give you these little kinds of clues, right?
Yeah, he was very responsive to the world around him. And this is something I tell my students all the time, that Shakespeare is not universal in the ways that we often think of that or the ways that it's often attributed to him. Shakespeare was very local, and he was responding to events around him as they were happening. And you can see that, that he's a very engaged writer with his culture. And it's often been thought that he relied, you know, it's as if Shakespeare's a scholarly writer, you know, imagining that he's sitting down at his writing desk with piles of books surrounding him. Well, he did rely on books himself, but we don't know what else he was relying on, because you can't recover a lost ballad that he heard walking down the street or the conversations that he had. So he was certainly a very engaged writer. We don't really know what he did think about his own status as an author, and it's not something that he necessarily had an ambition for. He was a member of a theater company and a part owner, and so it's possible that he, you know, recognized his burgeoning fame in the world of print, but he didn't seem to leave behind any evidence for us that he was terribly invested in that.
We're talking about the life and work of William Shakespeare this hour. Adam Hooks is my guest. He's the author of Selling Shakespeare, Biography, Bibliography, and the Book Trade. If you have questions, you're welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Something else that you explore, I guess one of the big questions is, why do we keep asking questions about William Shakespeare? I mean, 400 years after his death, we're still trying to explore his life. Why?
That is both the motivation and the perpetual activity of my career, I feel like. You know, I was a Midwestern farm boy growing up, and I knew that Shakespeare was important, but I had no idea why. And that still motivates me to try to explain why we continue to ask questions. And for me, the excitement is really trying to find new questions to ask of Shakespeare. One of the answers that I've come to is that scholars have often told narratives about Shakespeare's work, you know, this new theater industry and plays being printed as a kind of on the low end of the market, not having the same kinds of literary or other forms of status that other kinds of work did, and point to moments like the publication of the First Folio, where it's published in a larger format, clearly a bit more of a prestigious book. So that people want to find the moment when Shakespeare's plays become Shakespeare's literary masterpieces. And in fact, what I've found out that is that it's not that plays become literature, it's that plays simply became plays, in the sense that later in the 17th century, booksellers started to create these amazing catalogs, all the plays that ever yet were printed and published, and organizing them by genre and by author. And so that initial success in the print industry, which was based on the fact that they were not worthy literary works, is in fact the thing that helped it become a distinctive genre and helped Shakespeare become identified as one of, if not the leading figure associated with that genre.
Because even though they weren't considered to be high literature, they were so popular.
Exactly. They were popular. They were stylistically complex. People loved to read them. They wanted to use and repurpose those texts for all sorts of different reasons. There were many folks in the Renaissance, ancestors of our own Puritan nation, I suppose, that reacted against plays. Anti-theatrical polemic was and remains a really interesting genre to read, and they denigrated plays in print, saying that they were vendible, which just meant they're just sellable. They're not really worth anything. They don't have any ethical or intellectual profit, let alone spiritual profit. They're just profit in the financial sense.
So maybe the way that some people talk about Harlequin romances today.
Exactly. Yeah. The kinds of distinctive genres that are easy to marginalize and yet remain terribly popular.
Right. And are certainly touching a chord with the public.
Exactly.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest is Adam Hooks. He's an assistant professor in the Department of English and the Center for the Book at the University of Iowa. He is author of Selling Shakespeare, Biography, Bibliography, and the Book Trade. You are welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the life and work of William Shakespeare. My guest is Adam Hooks. He's an assistant professor in the Department of English and the Center for the Book at the University of Iowa and author of Selling Shakespeare, Biography, Bibliography, and the Book Trade, looking at Shakespeare's life through his published work and his relationship with the publishing industry of the time. You're welcome to join the conversation, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Rihanna is on the line from Fairfield. Hello.
Hi. Yeah. I'd like a clarification. In this conversation, you're talking about comparing them to kinds of ways things would be sold today. My understanding is in that time, most people didn't read. You had your elite class who was educated and could read, and I'm assuming, but this is my wanting clarification, that what was sold was to the elite class, and that's the discussion. And then in your theater, you had a mixture between your elites who were going to see performances, but also the others who couldn't read but loved the plays. Because today, most people can read, so when you're talking about publishing books, somebody listening today would mix up the fact that it's a completely different public in terms of literacy.
That's a great question. Yeah, fill us in on that. I've been trying to put this in context, but also let's put it in context of society at that time.
Yeah, so I would say that the audience for printed books or just printed matter of all kinds was much wider than we often think. Mm. It was not simply the elites and aristocrats that were able to read and that were publishing books. Certainly certain kinds of books were intended for an educated and scholarly audience or people of means to afford a large book. So that by the time Shakespeare's plays are published in the First Folio, that book was really only available to people of means, kind of the
right. It was
elites
very expensive,
yeah.
And the kind of thing that would be in a very elite library.
Exactly. On the other hand, there literacy was more widespread than we often think. One of the reasons for the flourishing of English literature around the end of the 16th and into the 17th centuries was the humanist educational reforms instituted much earlier in the 16th century. So you have a much wider public that is able to read and engage with texts. And also, we need to expand what we consider forms of reading. Reading took place in an astonishing array of environments for multiple purposes. And so you could interact with a printed text even if you weren't what we today would consider completely or fully literate. It's been a question that's vexing for a long time. It's very difficult to recover rates of literacy. But I would say that particularly in London, this is a city that is just filled with text everywhere. Title pages from books were posted up as advertisements. There were playbills. People gathered to talk and converse and gossip and share news. And also, I mean, there are different levels of literacy as well. And the example I like to use is that very often ballads, which were obviously meant to be sung and printed very cheaply on a single sheet of paper. Ballads were often made out of plays. So we know that there was a ballad of Romeo and Juliet. It's just that it doesn't survive like so many other ballads. And so that's yet a different way that it's not reading Shakespeare in the sense that students in my Shakespeare class would read Shakespeare, but it still is engaging with a text, probably in a communal setting. So I think that there was so many different forms of printed matter in England in the Renaissance, and there were so many different ways of interacting with it. Using rather than reading is a better way to think about interacting with books. Cutting them apart and pasting them up on your walls as well. It's not reading, but it's certainly using a book.
Rihanna, thank you so much for your call. That's a great question. And Jim is on the line next in Spencer. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I'm curious to know about some of the devices that Shakespeare used in his writing. And I'm kind of specifically wondering about play within a play, story within a story. Is that something that he created himself, or was that well known, well used?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that. I just taught the play within a play scene in Hamlet on Monday this week, and we spent a long time talking about that. That is not something that Shakespeare invented. That was a trope that had been used in plays long before Shakespeare. What Shakespeare often does is take kinds of conventional devices like a play within a play or certain kinds of plot lines and adapt them for his own purposes. So there was a play on the story of Hamlet that predates Shakespeare's play of Hamlet. And this happened with King Lear, with Henry V, with several other plays where he takes an existing – one of the sources he uses – is an existing play on the same story, but then he does something very different with it. And so the interesting thing then is to see how Shakespeare uses a particular device within the world of the play as he and his collaborators created it.
Jim, thank you so much for that question, and it leads us into a conversation about Shakespeare's collaborators. We just learned a little over a week ago that Oxford University Press, in its new edition of The Complete Works of William Shakespeare, is crediting Christopher Marlowe as co-author of three Henry VI plays. And this is something that has been a controversial subject for many, many years. So what is your take on that? What is your reaction to that news?
I have about three different reactions for you, and I'll try to give you the brief version of all of those. The first is simply to state that the theater and the practice of writing plays was a fundamentally collaborative enterprise. It's not simply at the level of writing, multiple people getting together to produce a play script and to sell it to a theater company. We know this happened a lot. We know that Shakespeare collaborated with other writers. And in Shakespeare's case, he had a somewhat unique position as a part owner of his theater company. So he's also working very closely with the actors who are going to perform his plays. And over time, you can really see honing and developing roles that fit the skills of particular actors. So we know that Shakespeare was a collaborator, and we've known for a long time that some of the plays include the work of other writers. The new Oxford Shakespeare, the attributions that they have provided in their new edition, which full disclosure, I haven't seen yet, but I know a fair amount about this. They've used the methods of something that's often called attribution studies or stylometrics, examining, analyzing a corpus of texts to see if you can find a distinctive authorial signature, using computer analysis and algorithms to attempt to discern how particular writers used particular kinds of language. And it's normally not the easily imitated parts that they focus on. It's the more function words that you don't really think about while writing. And so they've used that method and they've analyzed Shakespeare's plays and have decided that there's enough evidence from this method to warrant labeling Christopher Marlowe as one of the collaborators for the early Henry VI plays. It's possible, you know, it's not a fail-safe method by any stretch, because there are all sorts of interesting questions surrounding evidence and the particular methods, and so it will take a while for scholars to kind of evaluate this once we get our hands on it on everything. The final thing has to do with the name Christopher Marlowe, which is the name that the folks in the media really grasped onto. I mean, we've known for quite some time that, for example, Henry VI Part 1, or the play that we call Henry VI Part 1, was written in part by a writer named Thomas Nash. It's just that no one knows who Thomas Nash is, which is really unfortunate because everyone in the 1590s knew who Thomas Nash
anyone
was.
Anyone who was anyone, huh?
Anyone who was anyone. And he's just a fantastic stylist, and his prose just sparkles and crackles. But he didn't write a lot of plays. He's not nearly as well known. The interest comes from the fact that Marlowe has this reputation as the bad boy of the Renaissance theater, right? Like the best thing he ever did was get stabbed in a tavern brawl, which is how he died, and it made him notoriously famous. So if someone knows a playwright from the Renaissance that's not named Shakespeare, it's probably Marlowe.
But not necessarily for his work.
Not necessarily, although hopefully for his work. Dr. Faustus remains very, very popular. Marlowe's plays were very influential as the professional theater developed. And we know that that some of his plays influenced Shakespeare. I mean, you know, Venus and Adonis was Shakespeare's love poem. Hero and Leander was Marlowe's similarly erotic poem. They wrote several plays that are somewhat similar as far as the subject matter and the narrative. So there's always been a desire to, like, did Marlowe influenced Shakespeare? Did Shakespeare influence Marlowe? How can we tell? Well, we only have the text to go by. So this gives us a way, again, to use bibliographical evidence to make a biographical claim that places these two people that we so desperately want together, actually together.
So it sounds like you feel like it's a possibility, but not necessarily definitive evidence.
Well, it's difficult for any evidence of this kind to be definitive. It's certainly plausible and likely, and it actually helps make sense out of some of the editorial problems that people have always encountered with the Henry VI plays, which are kind of messy. Characters are called by different names, and locations shift in odd ways, and words, odd words or phrases have to be amended so that they make sense. But if you know that or think that you know that different writers contributed to it, and you think you know which writers are more likely than not to have written those sections, well, then that really does help make some sense out of some of the problems that we've always seen in the plays. It turns out they're not problems. They're just a result of a totally natural way to write a play.
Why do you think this idea is so captivating for people? It's something that has come up time and time again. Oh, Shakespeare didn't write Shakespeare. That's a story that really seems to appeal to people.
Yeah, I suppose that's another element of this. And again, I'm always more interested in why people think this is important. for myself, I even say this in my book. Like, I'm as far as this project goes, I'm not concerned with Shakespeare's desires and intentions. They may be irrecoverable at any rate. So I just want to know why we want to we desire to know that. This is a perpetual kind of conspiracy theory. My students ask me it during the first week of every semester. No one ever thought that Shakespeare didn't write Shakespeare until well into the 19th century, when he had become this gigantic canonical figure, when the kind of cultural status, the iconic status of Shakespeare seemed so large that how could any one person ever be responsible for it? Well, one person wasn't, because we know he collaborated, and the reason that he became that figure, you know, was centuries of admirers and readers and performers and collectors, et cetera.
And so much of it after his death.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. I mean, we talked about this before, but the first folio itself could only be a posthumous book. He could only start this transformation once there was the illusion of completeness. In some sense, it's a misunderstanding of how history works to a certain degree. Shakespeare didn't go to college. Well, you know what? By the time he finished grammar school, he knew more than a classics major does when they graduate today. And so when my students ask this, particularly my English majors, many of whom want to be writers of one kind or another, I say, so someone who grew up in a small town in the middle of the country and went off to the big city, that person isn't qualified, is not capable of writing amazing imaginative works? Because I think you guys are. And I think that it's just that we have a certain image over time that has warped our view of what Shakespeare is. And so I see my goal both as a scholar and a teacher to find new stories to tell and to find new ways to understand the stories that we already think that we know.
What is the next question that you want to pursue when it comes to Shakespeare?
I will say that my next project, the next question that I want to ask has to do with something I like to call faking Shakespeare. And not in the sense of like famous and scandalous forgeries. Those have been written about plenty over the years. I'm thinking about some of these earlier marginal forms of text, these kinds of marginal stories that at some point became not Shakespeare. That's what I want to talk about. I want to recover some of those lost stories and give them new life, breathe some new life into those stories.
Adam Hooks, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity.
Adam Hooks is the author of Selling Shakespeare, Biography, Bibliography, and The Book Trade. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Anna Williams, Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Claire Roth, and Emily Woodbury. We had production assistance today from Gray Lanta. You can email us anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.